Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the Wayne Eddy Affair on KYMN Radio on this beautiful, well, I think it's beautiful because there's no snow out there. It's a little bit overcast on this date. This is the August 20th, 2018 show on the Wayne Eddy Affair. But before we get any further, I got to tell you, last Saturday was 8/18/18, and my wife had a birthday. And I think Chip the Man had one, or maybe his was the 19th. But anyhow, my wife, as you know, I've been telling you, is the chairwoman of the Ambassador Program. And they went to North Hudson to the Pepper Fest on Saturday and represented the defeated Jesse James Day and also, of course, Northfield, Minnesota. And they have a tradition in North Hudson at their huge celebration, and that's a spaghetti eating contest. And the young ladies that represent the defeated Jesse James Days, both the ones that were given the crown a week ago last Friday, and those that are, well, it was their last appearance. And the spaghetti eating contest drew the attention of Carolyn Meyer, who, of course, was ambassador for Northfield and then went on to the Minneapolis Aquitennial and became Queen of the Lakes 2 years, 3 years ago. Anyhow, she is tops. She actually beat everybody, men, women, girls, that it was funnier than heck. She downed half a pound, I think it was, of spaghetti in 23 seconds. And nobody had beat her the first time she did it, and she came back to do it again. A lot of fun. I sent my wife a text message. They were on the road about 7 o'clock to get over there and do all the things they do. And I sent her a text on her birthday at 8:18 in the morning. 8:18. Yeah, it was a lot of fun. But anyhow, the weekend was great. I hope yours was too. And I'm kicking the week off this morning on a pretty good deal. And that is, I have a guy that I immediately liked after meeting him about 3-5 months ago. And Jerry Lance, welcome to the Wayne Eddy Affair on KYMN.
It's great to be back with you, Wayne.
All the way from Rochester, Minnesota.
Yes, the southern part of the state. The drive up was lovely, as always. And as I was coming across, first of all, Route 9, coming out of and through Stanton and all that, and then 19, the corn is so high. The corn is just amazing, and when it's not corn, it's soybeans. You know,
yes,
that's what we get, one or the other, all the way across. And they're both lovely to look at. And I remember, driving across. I'll tell you something. I have a summer orchestra in the Twin Cities. Minneapolis Pops Orchestra does concerts at Lake Harriet Bandshell Saturday and Sunday for 5 weekends in a row. They were all in July this year. And every Sunday on the way up to the 5:30 concert, I would come up here and stop for coffee and a delicious gluten-free, I'm not a gluten-free guy necessarily, but this was a good one, flourless chocolate torte at a place right down the street from us here.
Cupcake?
No, it was Hideaway.
Hideaway. Yep. Oh, good. Hideaway. Jim and Joan.
They're great.
Yeah.
And so we would come across those roads every week, and I'd see the corn get a little higher.
Okay.
Every week.
Yep.
And now it's gigantic, positively. It's probably taller than I am.
You know, I do the same thing. And I watch the corn, and I've been places where the corn is not as good as it is here.
It's really very rich, very tall, and we're going to have a good crop this year. And then that doesn't always help the prices. You have such a good crop, the prices die. But
you know, if the farmers get good prices, then the fertilizer and the seed and everything else goes up.
It's amazing how that happens.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. But you remind me, and I'm sitting here trying to remember his name, Bob is his Warner. I was sitting in a place called Tiny's. It's not there anymore. It's a little coffee shop, magazines, candy bars, and a lot of tobacco. And I was talking to him one time during a crisis in the fact that we weren't getting rain or whatever
is.
And he says, it's really amazing how some people, some farmers, really get all nervous about everything. He says, but I've been farming for 40-some years, and it's always a good crop in this particular area around Northfield.
That is very nice, because we know places where it almost always isn't a good crop.
Yeah, okay.
You know? So Northfield is a wonderfully prosperous place to be.
And I have to point something out, and not to embarrass you, but when you came up here and you took 9, you went through Denison.
Yes.
And but you mentioned 19 and Hampton. So
we got 19 in Stanton.
Stanton
zone, yeah. 19, yeah.
That's what you usually do, or 9 is the one?
We come over 9, and then we come up 56, and then we get on 19 and continue on west.
Say, was that a big concert this past weekend, the youth concert in Rochester? Was that part of your...
That was nothing to do with us, nope.
Well, but it said Rochester Symphony or something like that.
We didn't have one this past weekend. No,
okay,
sir.
Well, let me check this, all right? Okay.
If it's Rochester Symphony, I was deeply involved, but there wasn't anything.
The Rochester Philharmonic Youth Orchestra and Hochstein Youth Symphony Orchestra.
Rochester Philharmonic is in New York State.
Okay. I was wondering if I was going to get Minnesota
there. There are Rochesters, as I understand it, in 13 different states. And the most familiar are Rochester, New Hampshire, Rochester, Michigan, Rochester, Minnesota, and Rochester, New York. And I have conducted the Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra in New York a number of times.
Oh.
Not terribly recently, 15, 20 years ago. And they're a wonderful orchestra, great fun. Love to be there. They perform in the Eastman Theater at the Eastman School of Music. Great place. And so if they had a riotous affair, that was in Rochester, New York.
Okay.
Now, on the Genesee River.
Yeah, but I am not really good with the smartphone. And I looked you up on Facebook.
Uh-oh.
Personally.
Yeah, I'm not on Facebook.
You're not.
Nobody wants my face on a book, so I'm not on.
All right. Jerry Lancer is some guy that's out there by your name. But then I did Rochester Symphony, and it went right to, evidently, not yours. I just glanced at it. But do you have a website?
We have a website with the Rochester Symphony. We also have, we're on Facebook as well, with our symphony. I don't know how to run that.
Neither do I.
Somebody knows how to do that. I don't.
So you have a website. So if I wanted to look you up, how...
Go to Rochester Symphony in Minnesota. Put Minnesota in there.
Yeah, but would I do that with email, or would I do it with...
Go on Safari.
Facebook. Oh, Safari. Okay. That's another one that confuses me. Anyhow, I'm glad you're here.
Me too.
Because you've been busy since I've seen you last, and this is our, what, third meeting?
I believe so.
Okay. And we went through your life and all that.
Well, we were up in middle school when we quit. I don't know how we managed to do
okay.
that.
Okay. Well, thank you for reminding me, because you'll have to excuse me. I talk to a lot of people.
Of course you do, every day.
And I wonder, you know, I once we start clicking, then my memory comes back. So let's do that. Let's get you back up to middle school in a brief thumbnail sketch. Jerry Lance, by the way, has a great title. He is the conductor, manager.
My official title is President, CEO, and Artistic Director. I mean, that's a little too much for anybody to handle, of the Rochester Symphony in the southern part of the state. President, CEO, and Artistic Director.
Okay.
And it's a peculiar position in that in most symphony orchestras, symphony organizations, there are two people who hold those positions. One is the artistic type, the conductor, and the other is the executive type, the manager, the business guy. And I'm one of the few in the country, one of the few symphony orchestra organizations in the country foolhardy enough to put the same person in both organizations. I think enthusiasm outran common sense in that case.
Now, I remember talking about that, because I had seen your sign in the building that Lynn Lab is in, and you were on the third floor.
That's true. That's true. We've moved from that building now because Winona State University took over the floor we were on. We had to depart. Lynn Lab is a great organization, I know, for you and for many people.
Yeah. So where are you at now?
We're in off of Salem Road in southwest Rochester. We're in a big building that has many different organizations. It has a Republican Party of Olmsted County. It has lawyers. It has accountants. It has insurance organizations. It has all sorts of disreputable folks, so they left us.
You know, I was thinking when you said lawyers and then you said accountants, and there are people that say, you know what, why don't we just make it real simple? If you make $50,000 a year, $25,000 a year, $1 million a year, give 10% to the federal government, and it'll be all over.
And cut it right off there. Make it simple. No deductions, no anything.
Yeah, just here's your 10%.
Oh, boy. We could get really started on something here, Wayne.
Who do you think lobbies against that idea?
That's a good question. The wealthy.
The accountants.
Oh, the accountants. Yeah, they wouldn't need them anymore.
Yeah, because you wouldn't need them.
Right.
You know,
right.
Here's my W-2 or whatever it is,
sure.
Form, and here's your 10%.
Here's your share, and
goodbye,
I'm done.
Good luck, and God bless.
Yeah.
And but there's probably a lot of arguments about that. But anyhow, I don't even know why I went there with that. Oh, you said accountants.
There were accountants in our building, yes.
Okay, so let's get from birth to middle school in a quick way.
Well,
you were born where?
I was born in East Stroudsburg in the Pocono Mountains of Pennsylvania, northeast Pennsylvania, where my mother was a homemaker at the time. She had been a chemist, and she turned back to teaching chemistry in high school and physics all three of us kids got into school. My dad was a life insurance salesman, like his dad before him. And had
What company?
Massachusetts Mutual.
Oh, I've heard of that.
Yeah, and they're still vigorous. There's a building right near where I work in Rochester. There's a Mass Mutual building. And so I grew up there as a kid.
And siblings?
Yeah, I have an older brother and a younger sister. I'm the middle child.
How much older is your brother?
He's 2 years older. My sister's 3 years younger.
So it was a lively household.
It was, indeed.
Yeah.
Yep, busy. We all played piano, practiced at different times. Sometimes we played trios together, sitting at the one keyboard.
Here you are now, a man that knows music, writes music, scores music, arranges music, plays music. Did you hate piano practice?
No, didn't. And my mother was very smart. She said she played piano when we were kids. We would sit near her around. They had a long piano bench. We'd sit around her, and she would play the old song. She'd play "I've Been Working on the Railroad" or "On Top of Old Smokey."
I know all of those.
Of course you do. We're of a vintage. But anyway, and we said, "Well, we want to be able to play. We want to be able to play." She said, "Well, I'll make you a deal. You can have piano lessons, but if you have piano lessons, I'm not going to tell you to practice. You make a deal right now that you will practice half hour a day when you get older, an hour a day, that's it, okay? And I'm not going to sit around and yell at you and make you practice. You're going to make yourself practice." So we took that seriously, and we did.
So how did you split up the time? I mean, if you both have an hour, that's 3 hours of the piano going.
Yeah. Well, we just worked it out somehow.
Who was the most adept?
That's hard to say.
Well, were you tied for first place, or
we were all pretty good at it. My brother and I, and when we took piano lessons, instead of each person having a half hour lesson, which is usually the case, we took a 1 hour lesson together.
Okay.
So we'd be going through the same. We started at the same time. Okay. He was 2 years older, but we started at the same time. So we'd be going through these books, and he would learn the piece, and I would learn the same piece. So the teacher would have him play the piece first and have me play the piece. Then we went to the next one. I would play it first, and then he would play it.
Okay.
Well, we were so highly competitive that within 1 year, we got through 3 years' worth of books because nobody wanted to get beat, right?
Okay. I get it. Competition
is... So we really got going. Our piano teacher was so amazing that by the time I was nine, I'd been playing for about a year or a year and a half. He started to teach us chords and harmony and all that sort of thing. And we would write like hymns when we were kids. And we had to identify the chords by their titles and numbers and all that sort of thing. And so I was learning music theory before I was 10 years old. I didn't know that was unusual. He just thought he'd have a little experiment with us, and so he did. And my brother ended up majoring in music in college and then going into business afterward. I ended up majoring in economics in college and going into music afterward. So we kind of swapped.
Well, did you start with chopsticks?
No.
Well, you say that with...
No, you never learn chopsticks in a piano lesson. No reputable piano teacher teaches chopsticks.
That's just for...
You just pick
introduction.
It up. Yeah, you just kind of pick it up along the way. It's not in any of the books that I've ever seen.
I think I may have mentioned it. There was a guy by the name of Earl Nightingale who told a story about, oh, I'd give anything to be able to do that, and ended up saying, no, you wouldn't, or you would. So when I say I'd give anything to be able to play the piano, well, obviously I didn't give anything.
Yeah, right.
So I can't.
Yeah. I mean, some people might say without thinking, I'd give my left arm to play the piano. But then if you gave your left arm, you wouldn't be able to play the piano. So
I told once that I bought a car, and it was expensive. It cost an arm and a leg.
There you go.
For half price.
Very good.
You got it.
Okay. I got it.
So, what was your going up to? We're going up to middle school.
Yep.
What was it like going through grade school? Was it a public school?
Yep, went through a public school. It was interesting. It was a part of a college campus, East Stroudsburg State College, now East Stroudsburg State University, is primarily a place where teachers go to learn to teach. It's an education college. And so there was an elementary school right on the campus. And so we had a lot of students who were involved with our education and teaching us and all that sort of thing.
Was it a private school?
No.
Public school, and you lived nearby it.
Yeah, our East Stroudsburg school district happened to include a school that was on the campus.
Oh, that was beneficial.
It was beneficial all around.
When you were in the fourth, fifth, sixth grade, was it... were you a sissy because you played the piano and liked music?
Well, I tried not to be.
Okay.
I also played football and baseball.
Oh,
not
okay.
Terribly well, I admit.
Yeah.
But I was in Little League. I played 1 year of midget football, and one time I got a knee under my jaw. I was trying to tackle a quarterback who was very agile. He caught me in the jaw with his knee, and I put my teeth right through my lower lip.
Ow.
Yeah, it hurt. I kept playing anyway.
Yeah, but the blood...
I was a tough little guy.
Yeah, the blood looked good, didn't it?
Macho for a day. That was about it.
Remember when you were jealous of people that wore a cast?
No, I was never jealous of people who wore a cast.
When I say jealous...
No, but I never wanted to be in that kind of enviable position. Some people said, hey, look at my cast. And I said, no thanks. I'll stay away from that.
Well, you autograph it, you know. But, just like, hey, man, look at that kid. He broke his arm and he's not crying.
I gotta tell you, one of my favorite New Yorker cartoons of all time, Wayne, is a picture of George Washington sitting with his general's uniform on in the tent, you know, with his leg up, and he's got a cast on, right? And it's signed Thomas Jefferson, John Hancock, Benjamin Franklin, you know, all the guys who signed the Declaration have signed
That's
George
funny.
Washington's cast.
That's funny.
That was really funny.
9:20 on the Wayne Eddy Affair on the 195.1. Our guest this morning is a president, CEO, the artistic director of the Rochester Philharmonic.
Rochester Symphony.
Rochester Symphony.
The Philharmonic is in New York.
What's the difference?
No, just the name.
You can call it a... Okay.
It's to distinguish from some other orchestra. Philharmonic was a word that was coined toward the end of the 19th century, and some organizations picked that up. We have the New York Philharmonic. We have the Rochester Philharmonic. They're both in New York. There aren't a lot of orchestras called Philharmonic. There's a London Philharmonic. But then we have symphonies. And there are some that are simply called Orchestra, Philadelphia Orchestra, Chicago Symphony Orchestra, I don't know.
Okay.
And it used to be the Minneapolis Symphony Orchestra, now it's the Minnesota Orchestra, same gang.
Doesn't St. Paul have a nice orchestra?
They have a chamber orchestra, St. Paul Chamber Orchestra.
Okay. What's
group.
A chamber? Oh, a smaller,
okay. Smaller group.
Is that just every instrument, but just fewer of them?
No, it is all the main strings and winds and fewer of them, but then there's some instruments they don't have. They don't have trombones regularly. They don't have tuba regularly, that sort of thing.
I was watching a conductor on TV for just a little bit recently, and I looked at him and I thought, you know, it looks easy to stand there and keep rhythm, and, you know, it would be very pleasurable to be in front of an orchestra, keeping the beat for them, and then looking at the little when it's time for the bell, to look at them and gesture. And then when the violins get violent, it just seems like it would be so much work to do that, but so much joy. And then you stop and you go, wait a minute, Wayne, that looks like fun. It looks like work. But holy cow, her main job, is to get them to that position to make the performance and all the rehearsals and all the arrangement and the consideration of this and that and adding their own personality to a piece that's very popular. Am I on the right road?
I've never heard it said better. That's exactly what we do as conductors. I've never heard anyone sum it up without using technical musical terms as well as you have. That's exactly what's done, and it is work and it is fun, but there's a tremendous work on the way, and the main work, of course, is in the rehearsal. And the conductor's major time is actually spent before the first rehearsal, figuring out the music, how it's supposed to go, what you want to do it, how to put your own interpretation in, all those things you said. You got it. You nailed it exactly. You should have been a conductor.
I would love it, but Descent. Do you ever have somebody, from the horn section, let's say, no, that's not going to work with this trombone?
As a matter of fact, you get that occasionally. The real professionals don't do it in front of other people. They come to you privately, and then you talk it out, and you work it out. But in my situation, the conductor is the boss. It's one of the few places where dictatorship is still very much in order. And you talk it out, you work it out, and then you say, I'd like you to do it this way.
And so it's autocratic.
It is.
I just had a thought just fly through my head. Anyhow, we're getting into high school now.
Yep, we are. I was lucky. My high school, East Stroudsburg High School, was actually East Stroudsburg Junior Senior High School. The term middle school we weren't using in those days, were we, Wayne?
No, I went to Catholic schools 1 through 8 and 9 through 12.
There you go.
Well,
yeah, sure.
No, just not 10, I got kicked out. Or I wasn't invited back my junior year. Is that you or me? That must be me.
That's you. Yeah, yep. You're dinging.
Did you hear that ding, folks? I don't know what that means, but I'm going to put it in this drawer in case it goes off. And then, because I don't know how to turn it off, then I'm going to close it and I'll forget it.
Well, my wife reminded me to turn mine off. And by the way, happy birthday to your wife. My wife's is coming up in another week and a half. She's on the 30th of August.
So. What are you going to get her?
I'm taking her on a trip.
Oh, okay. Well,
we're going up to Grandview Lodge in Nisswa near Brainerd for a week.
I get invitations there at least 3 times a week because I spent some time there one time.
Yeah.
Don't give out your... Well, they find you anyhow.
Oh, that's not a worry. We know how to resist temptation.
Well, I'll tell you what. When you go to the quarterback club and you want to have a nice lunch or a breakfast...
Right here in town, yep.
Yep, you can't resist the temptation to try some of their delicious burgers for lunch or their baby back barbecued ribs with mountains of madness just oozing all over them in a
form of a special breakfast barbecue. I didn't have much for breakfast. You're making my tummy rumble.
Well, I'll tell you what. The quarterback club is a great place to have breakfast. Unfortunately, they do only serve it till 10, so you won't be able to take advantage of
all
that.
Right.
But remember them the next time you stop through town, because I don't know what you like, a heavy breakfast or a light breakfast?
I usually have a light breakfast, but when I go out, I go for it.
Yeah, and they got it. They have anything you want. The Quarterback Club is locally owned and locally managed, established by members of the Minnesota Vikings in 1967, and a failed attempt to put together a whole string of them. They had several, but they all failed. And so
But the quarterback club is still going strong right here in Northfield.
Yeah, because some local people got her going.
Fantastic.
First guy named Swanson for about a year, then Larry Benjamin, the late Larry, a good friend, and then now Dale Finger. So anyhow, at 9:26 on 1080 Radio, if you just tuned in, I've got the president, the CEO, the artistic director of the Rochester Symphony Orchestra with me, Jerry Lance, his third visit here on KYMN Radio. First time you came with... you came with the banker.
I did.
Yeah.
Brad Crable.
Yeah, nice guy.
Home Federal Bank, yeah. Wonderful guy.
So, in high school now, did you forego sports because you want to keep your fingers...
I'll tell you a story.
Yes.
I'll tell you a story.
Tell me many.
I got into seventh grade. I was almost as tall as I am now. which isn't that tall. I'm about 5'9". But I was taller than most of my buds. I was really into basketball. Loved basketball. And I knew how to jump. So I was somehow appointed a captain of a basketball team. So I chose my own team for the league. We won the league. I was the high scorer. And the second highest scorer was my buddy Craig. And it was great. Eighth grade, coming back next year, I was appointed captain again. But because of a rehearsal, a band rehearsal, I couldn't go to the time you were supposed to pick teams. So I sent somebody else to pick teams. He didn't do such a good job. Instead of coming out first in the league, we came out last in the league. Craig was no longer on my team, unfortunately. I tried to work hard, but I didn't have much of a team, and so we didn't win very many games. And I thought I had made the decision at that point that music on that day was more important to me than sports. So I quit sports.
Okay. And were you, when you got into the band, I mm-hmm. assume, did that high school have, what type of bands did they have?
Well, we had your standard marching and concert bands. But let me tell you, the East Stroudsburg High School Band was the best band around. They would have, there was a regional band. A district band. There's districts and regions. Districts took up 30 to 35 schools, and you sent your best players to audition. And there was one year that in about the 110 people that made the district band, over 30 of them, more than a quarter of them, were from East Stroudsburg High School.
Wow.
That's how good our band program was. And if it weren't for that wonderful band program I had in junior and senior high, I wouldn't be in music today.
Well, what was that like in your senior high? Did you perform just during the school year, or did join a summer outfit?
It was a really interesting situation. We had, first of all, a junior-senior high school. Both 7 through 9 was junior high, 10 through 12 was senior high. Junior high, 7 through 9, was on the first floor of the building. Senior high was on the second floor of the building. And so I was in the same building with the same band director for 6 years. In the summer, Robert Zellner, Mr. Z, as we called him, ran 6 weeks of summer band, which was paid for by the band mothers. These are the people who had cakewalks and other sales and things to raise money to support the band, and bought the uniforms for the band and all sorts of things. And I would go several times a week to band in the summer during those 6 weeks. We had a junior high band and junior high low brass, trombones, baritones, basses playing together. Then we had senior high band and senior high marching band, and also the senior high low brass. And we had my favorite period in the afternoon from 2 to 5 every Friday afternoon was jazz band. Oh, did we have fun just playing jazz band together.
What were you using as an instrument?
I was a trombonist then.
Okay.
Yeah. And I love to play trombone. I play in the concert band, the marching band, and the jazz band. And if you were in junior high, because we were in the same building, and you were pretty good, you could play in the senior high band too. So I was marching in my first parade with the senior high band. I was in ninth grade. We were in Allentown, Pennsylvania, about 30, 35 miles away from East Stroudsburg, where I was born. It was a summer marching. I don't know what the occasion was, 4th of July or something. We were doing a summer parade. It was really hot. And we had wool uniforms. The wool uniforms that had to keep us warm during the football games in the fall when it gets chilly in October and November. And I started to feel a little woozy. Maybe I didn't have enough for lunch or whatever, but I was feeling woozy. I said, Mr. Z, I can't keep marching. And I went over on the side, and I totally collapsed. I fainted. And I woke up in somebody's house. Some nice family had taken me into their house.
Wow.
And I don't remember how I got reunited with the band or Mr. Z or my family, but my family got worried when they were watching the parade, and I wasn't in the band.
Yeah, the band keeps marching on.
Yeah, that's right. Nobody could stop for me, but very kindly people.
Were you dehydrated?
I don't know.
Oh.
I don't know. I honestly don't remember too well because I was 14 and I was like, a little crazy.
Now, you see you're from East Stroudsburg.
Stroudsburg.
How do you spell that?
It's S-T-R-O-U-D-S and then Berg, B-U-R-G. Stroudsburg. Okay. Named for a man named Jacob Stroud, who settled that area first.
That's Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvania, northeast
now,
Pennsylvania.
Now, how close were you to New Jersey?
My house?
Yeah.
3.5 miles.
Okay. Now, when I think of music and I think of New Jersey, I think about their drum and bugle corps.
A lot of stuff. And we had drum and bugle corps in our my hometown of East Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania, as well. And people were really into that. I was never part of that or interested in that, though I enjoyed hearing them in the parades
trombone,
I started marching.
They wouldn't have a trombone.
They wouldn't have a trombone, but they would have instruments with vowels that were in the trombone range, and I could have gotten involved in that. Never did.
Okay, I just love them, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Now, when you were in the marching band, did you actually make formations on the football field?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, and crazy drills and things like that. When I was in, I remember, when I was in seventh grade, I told the band director, I said, you should form 1961, which was the year, on the plane, on the field, because whatever side of the field you're on, it looks like 1961 on, because okay, you read the same upside
true.
Down and right side up. And I said, Mr. Z, the next time that'll happen is in the year 6009, and we won't be around for that. So he did. At every football game, we formed out 1961 to, you know, commemorate the upright side, upside down year. And all, those are the crazy ideas I came up with when I was a kid.
Well, it's a great idea. 1961, I never thought of that. Of course, why would I have a reason to do that? I do have a reason to take a break, though. Will you stick by?
I'll try.
Jerry is my guest, Jerry Lantz, on the Wayne Eddy Affair. We'll be back in just a moment on KIM.
Hi, I'm April Kopak, manager at Three Links Apartments in Northfield. We are an active, independent community of older adults and disabled individuals. Our spacious one-bedroom apartments feature controlled key access, off-street parking, and are handicap accessible. This is a place to call home, make new friends, and participate in many activities and exercises. Tours are welcome. Please call Three Links Apartments at 664-8850 or find out more at threelinks.org.
When you need cement or masonry work done, think of D&S Cement in Northfield. D&S Cement provides superior concrete and masonry work. They pour walls for both home and business. Poured walls provide more strength and are more energy efficient. D&S also does concrete driveways, swimming pool decks, and has decorative concrete too. They'd be happy to provide you with an estimate and go over all of your plans. If you're building, contact D&S Cement in Northfield at 507-663-1294.
Of course, that's Dick Simon. And he's one of the best bowlers in the city of Northfield. Every Monday at 4 o'clock, he does his businessman bowling, sponsors a team, and just is a nice guy. Okay, speaking about nice guys, I have a fellow here by the name of Jerry Lantz. He is the president, the CEO, the administrative director of the Rochester Symphony Orchestra. And right now we're in Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania.
Yep.
And you're in senior high school. We've got you there now.
Yeah.
And 1961. And
that was when I was junior high. I graduated in 67.
Okay. Oh, wow. You came up with an idea in the seventh grade, and he took it?
Yeah. He I had known him from the summer band program, even when I was in elementary school. He was just a really wonderful director. Unfortunately, a couple years after I graduated from high school, he was appointed the director of bands at Gettysburg College in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, and left the high school. And unfortunately, the band was not as good after he left. It's too bad
now,
to say.
Now, you say you graduated in 1967.
Yes, sir.
So as an eighth grader, ninth grader, JFK was killed. Do you remember that date?
I remember it very well. We heard it when I was in English class. It was announced that he had been shot. That's all we knew at that point. And it just stunned us. It absolutely stunned us. And then I went to gym class, and we went out. We didn't go outside. We went to the basketball court. It was November, after all. And then we were back in the locker room at the end of gym class, and it was announced that the president had died. Yeah, I remember it very well.
Did you stay home and watch TV then?
Yes.
Glued to the television?
Absolutely.
Little John with the salute?
I saw all that. I did not see, I only saw it on the replay, Jack Ruby shooting Lee Harvey Oswald,
yeah,
which some other people actually saw live as it happened.
Yeah.
I didn't see that. But I glued to it and the parade and Jackie. It was a wrenching time. And then a couple years later, of course, six years later, we had the first man on the moon, Neil Armstrong, and all that. I was in college then, but I was glued to the TV that July as well.
Yeah. Do you think there's a conspiracy in regards to the JFK assassination?
No.
No?
No.
Okay, you accept what the Warren Commission
Pretty much.
Okay.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of conspiracy theorists out there who would like to make conspiracies out of everything, and sometimes the real answer is simpler than they would like it to be.
Well, we had a former governor that likes to chase conspiracies.
Really? We would never elect someone like that governor in Minnesota.
Yeah, you want to bet now? 9:36 on the Wayne Eddy Affair on the 195.1 FM. And, of course, September 27th, 50 years on the air for KYMN AM radio. Oh, I know what I got to say. I was talking about my wife's birthday is 8/18.
Yes.
I came to Northfield on 8/18 to start this radio station. It wasn't on the air. The tower was being built.
And what year was that, Wayne?
1968.
Oh, that's the year you're talking about, 50 years. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
So I have now lived in Northfield for 50 years and 2 days.
Good for you. I got to tell you something. I have been coming to Northfield more often because you invited me a couple months ago to come up for the first time to talk with you. And on one of the times, I don't remember, it was the first. No, it wasn't the first time. First time I drove up with Brad. The second time, my wife and I came up and decided to spend the night before at the Archer House next door.
Oh, cool.
And we had a great time, and we enjoyed getting to know Northfield and all that. We are seriously thinking, whenever we decide to retire, and I'm 69 years old now, and I accepted a new job when I was 66, and I promised them at least 5 years, so I don't know when it will be. But whenever we retire, if our kids are living nearby in Minnesota, as they hope to be, we may just do that in Northfield. We love Northfield.
Well, bless you. And I say that because there's a lot of retired ministers in this town.
Oh, I see. Okay, yeah. I'll have to watch my behavior then.
And by the way, folks, Jerry does not look 69 years old, and he's got this nice head of hair, and it's all gray. And if you were to allow that to grow, it's over your ears.
Yeah, it kind of is. Well, we had longer hair back in the 60s, you know, in the 70s when I was growing up. And since I became a conductor, I didn't have to cut it. You know?
Right, that's what
I was
going
to. If I
was
going into business or law or something like that, or medicine, I probably would have cut it back because that's, you know, you have to have that trim aware look. But I kept the hair long and I enjoyed it. In fact, I grayed early. You know, I was in my 30s when it was getting gray. I was once accused by a member of a chorus I was conducting of dyeing my hair to look more distinguished.
Okay.
It wasn't true. It was just turning gray.
I can visualize you allowing that to grow even beyond your ears and have it all messed up as you're doing the conducting. That seems like the...
Some years ago, when you hit it right on the head, so to speak, some years ago... I did this thing where I imitated Beethoven. So I put on, I talked like Beethoven, you know, and I told people about my music and how I make music, how I construct my symphony, you know. And to do that, I grew my hair longer, and I actually at one point got a permanent to make it wavier. But then my wife figured out how to make it work without doing the permanent thing. And so I had it really longer so I could look more like Beethoven, because his pictures as an older guy when he has gray hair, it was always longer. So, yeah, at one time it was longer.
Actually, I had a permanent back in the 70s. And there was a guy in town, worked for the newspaper. Some people remember Les Pulleyou was his name. And he teased me and kind of dissed me about going to a beauty salon and having my hair curled in a semi-afro or whatever you call it. And about 2 years later, he's walking down the street. People will know what I'm talking about, in front of Jacobson's, the former Jacobson's store. And, hi, how are you? We're walking by. And I stopped and, hey, Les. And he turns around. Yeah, he says, you got a permanent. You were giving me all this crap about a guy getting a permanent, and you got one.
Mm-hmm.
He says, yeah, but on me it looks good. I thought, what a comeback.
Yeah,
what a comeback.
There you go.
940 on 1080 KYMN Radio. My guest this morning is Jerry Lance. And, Jerry, we're in high school right now.
Yes,
you're
sir.
Getting ready to graduate.
Yep.
And when you did that, I don't know what if it's pomp and circumstance at graduation when the seniors come in to sit down and wait for their names to be called. Now, many seniors are in the band that are graduating.
That's right.
So you have the rest of the band doing the Pomp and Circumstance.
That's exactly right. And in fact, what happened when I was early in junior high and wasn't yet in the senior band, the band director, Mr. C, asked me to come in and play in the band for graduation because there were too many seniors on stage and they needed an extra trombone player. So I did that for a couple of years before I was actually in the high school band. But yeah, senior year, yeah. And that's true in college as well. Yeah, we had to do it that way. I got to tell you, though, one of the things I enjoyed most in high school, and it's the only time I've ever done it in my life, was theater. I wasn't particularly interested in theater or being in a play and all that, but the theater director was nervous. He was scared. He was desperate. So he asked me if I'd be in the play my junior year. And the play was a play called Green Grow the Lilacs, a Western play. A great musical, Oklahoma, was based on the play. Same story. They just added music to it. And I played the guy who in the musical and in the movie was named Judd Fry. In the play, he was Jeter Fry. Why they changed his name to Judd, I don't know. But he was the villain. He was the bad guy. He was nasty. So I was nasty in the play. I could be as nasty as I wanted to. It was great fun. And I had a gun that really shot. I mean, we had blanks in it, of course, but I had a gun that I would shoot during the play. I had great fun. And my buddy, Steve Courtwright, Steve is a great guy, played trumpet in the band and was on the football team. And he was playing Curly. He was a very good-looking guy, and he looked like the hero. I looked like the bum. And we would fight on stage, you know, with this knife, and eventually it would get into me, and, oh, I would die. And there was huge applause. And I never could figure out, to be honest, Wayne, whether the applause was so great when I got killed because I was such a great actor as being the villain, or because everybody hated my guts and they were glad to see me go.
Well, then you did a good job acting. And
I guess.
And I'll tell you what, I always say, you know, there's always a connection if you talk to somebody long enough.
Mm-hmm.
And my connection is I was what we call the NAG, Northfield Arts Guild Theater.
Sure.
And one of the plays I was in was called Jesse, of course, and it was a melodrama of the bank robbery and Jesse James.
Of course.
And it was funny, and I got the role of Clyde Wagstaff, and he was the guy that was the bad guy. And I whip Jesse James, and I shoot somebody, and sing. And no dancing, but singing.
You're a tough customer.
And it was just a blast. Just a blast, you know. I can sing some of the songs still, and that was in 1986.
Well, there you go. Sure. Yeah. Music stays with your memory a lot, and they're using music now. We're a co-sponsor of what they would call a dementia choir in Rochester.
Dementia.
Yeah.
Okay.
Called Resounding Voices, where people whose minds are not quite as together as they used to be, come and sing, and it wakes them up. It sharpens the mind. It's fantastic. So we're a co-sponsor. The president, the vice president, and the treasurer are all on our board of the symphony, and they work on those boards as well. And it's a wonderful thing. They've given one concert so far, and it's made of people who have mental issues, who are getting older, and a partner. They bring in somebody with them who is their friend or their relative, their child, their parent, their spouse, whatever. And it's going great.
Do you see blank faces light up?
Yes. Absolutely.
That's got to give you chills.
It is spectacular. Now, I'm not anything to do with it musically. I go and support it and all that. And my wife and her mom are about to join. Mom is will be 91 in a couple of weeks.
Oh, okay.
And my wife and her mom will be in that chorus, and they'll have a great time together.
Yep. Now, what did you say you're going to do for your wife's birthday?
We're going to go up north to Grandview Lodge.
Yeah, okay. Are you going to fish?
You know, I don't know. She was into fishing when she was young. I never was. And we'll see. You know what? There's all sorts of activities we can do.
You
boating
golf?
And I don't golf. I quit golfing when I was 20. I had golfed for several years with my father, and I enjoyed that a great deal. But then it takes a long time to go out and golf. So, and it's expensive. And I was a poor musician. Oh, that's redundant, I know, but I was a poor musician. And so I quit the golf when I was about 20.
Yeah. It just reminded me of something. There are so many humorous jokes and sayings among musicians that we, meaning people that don't know music, don't understand. Teasing a trombone player some way or another. But every instrument...
There's jokes about every instrument. That's true. Like they say, what is the viola is the poor man, as it were, of the string family. And so there are a lot of jokes about violas. They say, what's the range of a viola? Depends upon how hard you kick it.
You know? Okay.
that sort of thing. And with me, I'm a trombone player. I'm the only kind of person that can afford to let things slide. You know.
Was there a joke in that?
And as a trombone player?
Yeah. I don't get it because I don't. He's sliding his arm in and out.
Yeah.
And it reminds me of an ad I saw one time. Tuxedo, used only one time. Left arm longer than right arm.
Trombone player.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Well, you got it. So.
Well, I should drop a little gem here. I like to collect little trivial facts. Okay, I told you I was in a play called Green Grow the Lilacs. That was named after a song, and I wish I could sing you the song. I don't know the melody, but it was the song that was most popular among cowboys out west. When they were taking care of the cattle at night, they'd sing songs like Green Grow the Lilacs to keep them calm, because apparently the whole singing cowboy developed out of that was a good way to keep the cattle quiet in the evening, keep them sedate. So the people from south of the border heard so many cowboys singing Green Grow the Lilacs, they started to call them gringos or gringos. That's where the word gringo comes from that song, Green Grow the Lilacs.
I did not know that.
There you go. So we've enlightened some people in Northfield today.
Yeah. Well, good for you. I like that. I'm going to ask you I don't know how to do this. I don't know anything about classical music. But I like it, you know.
We need more of you.
But
need more of you.
I just think it's so. It can be so exciting, and it can be so relaxing, and you pay attention to it and the way they mix it, and how they'll have something on the left and something on the right and all that. And there are just a few things that I may be able to identify. Da da dun da da dun da da dun dun dun. Which is Lone Ranger.
Yes.
And it is from?
The William Tell Overture.
Yeah, that's right.
By Gioacchino Rossini. The last opera he ever wrote before he retired at the age of 37.
Okay.
He had made so much money he didn't want to bother to write any more music.
You know, and I knew that, William Tell Overture.
Sure.
Okay. This one I know. Dun, 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 dun.
Yep.
Beethoven?
Fifth Symphony.
Okay.
Yep.
Fifth Symphony. Is there something past that?
Yeah, oh, yeah, there's a lot more than that.
Fifth Symphony and then Frugal or whatever.
Oh, no, it's Symphony No. 5 in C minor.
Okay, that's...
Opus 67.
And so people that know the no music, they understand that. I look at that and I have no idea.
Sure.
Is C the middle note on the piano?
No, the middle notes on the piano are E and F. C is a little bit below that.
Okay.
But many people think it's because it's called middle C... It'll be what they refer to middle C is it's the C that's closest to the middle of the piano, but it's not in the middle.
Okay, what is the most common
key?
Yeah,
well, probably C because C the key of C has no sharps and no flats, no black keys. I mean, throughout a complex piece of music, you're changing keys from time to time. So there'll be no pieces except for very beginning students that will have only white keys. But there are more white keys in the key of C more frequently than any other. So it's the simplest key to start in. So many pieces are written in the key of C.
Okay. Now, which is sharp and which is flat?
Sharp is go up a half step. Go up to the next.
Okay. What do you call the white keys and the black keys?
I don't know.
They're
just called white keys and black keys, and not particularly interesting. Now, and you can have sharps that are white keys and flats that are white keys, but that's unusual, but it can be. For example, E and F are two notes that are right next to each other without a black key between them. So E sharp is the same as F. and F flat is the same as E. Have I confused you yet?
No, I'm just paying attention, and I'm tickling the 88s in
there
my
you go.
Mind.
There you go.
That's a phrase I thought was so cool when I heard it. Let's go tickle the 88s. Are there any pianos that have less or more?
Yes.
Really?
When pianos began, they didn't have nearly as many keys. They were down below 60. As a matter of fact, on Mozart's piano or Beethoven's piano early in his life, and it gradually got bigger during Beethoven's life. And I wish I could tell you exactly when the 88-key piano became standard. I don't know. There's a company called Bösendorfer in Germany that adds a few extra bass notes at the bottom, and the colors are reversed. You know, what is normally white keys are black, and when there's normally black keys are white in that little area, so you know when you're trending into that area, and they have a cover over them, so if you don't want them, you don't need to have them exposed. Okay. But generally, music isn't written for those notes because they've never been on the piano, but sometimes pianists add them to give a greater bass and depth to it, and so they have a few more than 88 keys, but that's highly unusual.
Well, when I was a kid, the jet airplane was something new.
Yeah.
And I remember going to the last five key, whatever my arm or hand could push down on the left.
Sure.
And I would push that down. I'd say to somebody, hey, what's this? Then I'd do that. Then I'd go up to the right.
Sure.
And then do this.
Mm-hmm.
As many.
And a higher crunch, yes.
Yeah. So you know what I was telling them to guess what it is?
Something to do with the jet engine? Or?
Yeah. Well, yeah. These are the bombers.
Uh-huh.
And these are the jets.
Okay.
The difference between... You just piqued my memory on that.
There you go.
I would have never thought again the rest of my life. I have a piano in my house. I never touch it. Well, a final break this hour. We'll be right back with Jerry Lance on the Wayne Eddy Affair.
Are you looking for spacious senior living in Northfield? Feel at home at Northfield Retirement Communities, Northwood Pines. Available for individuals and couples, this assisted living combines the privacy of one-bedroom plus den apartments with family-style meals and care available around the clock. Visit us online at northfieldretirement.org or call us today at 664-3466. Northfield Retirement Community. Innovation. Choice. Tradition.
If it doesn't challenge you, it doesn't change you. I'm Greg Berube, the owner of CrossFit Scopus. After spending time in our facility and with our team, we want our members to walk out of our doors feeling like a better version of themselves. You can lose weight, build muscle, and get a great workout in, but the community and support of Scopus will keep you coming back for more. Go to CrossFitScopus.com. We will help you build life-changing habits that improve your quality of life for now and for the future. We are CrossFit Scopus in Dundas, right by Menards.
We're back on the Wayne Eddy Affair on KYMN, a friend you can count on. I'm going to call. Thank you. A 2016 report indicated that nearly 34% of students between ages 12 and 17 have been victims of cyberbullying. Children face real dangers online, but how can parents protect their children without isolating them from the reality of our digitally connected world? Well, on today's 15 with the author, Terry Knight talks with Will Geddes. He is one of the world's leading security specialists, and he's out with a new book, Parent Alert, How to Keep Your Kids Safe Online. The book is set up with real-life scenarios and action plans, how to balance protecting your kids from danger without being critical of them. That's at 11 o'clock this morning on 15 with the author, with KYMN's own Terry Knight. That reminds me, when you were in high school in Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania, did you have, like you mentioned, your height, etc., did you have bullies in your school that you remember?
Yeah. Yeah, not a lot, but there were definitely some.
Were you ever afraid of them?
Yeah. What was interesting is, early on, there was a guy who was a bit of a bully, and he picked on me. And for some reason, I did something very uncharacteristic of me. I'm usually a peacenik. I hit him.
Who?
I socked him in the snout.
And?
He didn't bother me anymore, and neither did anybody else. So the word got out. And I'm not a tough guy. If I really got into a fight, I'd get clobbered.
But I just
popped him one because he was, you know, and so he didn't bother me anymore.
Well, that reminds me of a guy that was, back when I was in like the eighth grade, we had to wear corduroy pants.
Oh, sure. I still wear corduroy pants.
Okay. So anyhow.
Oh, you had to wear them for your Catholic school uniform.
Right.
Okay.
Right. So this guy was big and heavy and, you know, maybe he was called fat. And anyhow, him and I got into a skirmish, and I knew that he could kill me. Well, I was skinny and fast. And he chased me, and he chased me, and I'm getting exhausted. And I'm thinking, how can this guy keep up to me? Well, it wasn't all one big dash. It was a continual runaway. You know how he stayed ahead of him? I listened to his corduroy pants. And went, psh, 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 then I'd pick up. When it went, psh, 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 then I'd slow down. Eventually, we both got exhausted, and I hid underneath the car because I knew he couldn't get under the car. And
yeah, he was too big for that.
And I don't remember how it ended, but I just can picture that.
But you're here and healthy today. That's good.
Amen. I say unto you, 3 minutes before 10 o'clock on the Wayne Eddy Affair, my guest this morning is the president, CEO, administrative director of the Rochester Symphony. Jerry Lance is here, and this is his third visit, and we're keeping you in high school. So you stuck to music in high school.
Yep.
You did get into do a play. Did you get the bug at all and try for more?
I did my senior year. They were still desperate for guys, so they took me back in the play, and I had to do two roles because we were doing a play called The Miracle Worker, the story of Helen Keller and her blindness and how she meets up with Annie Sullivan, who begins to be a miracle worker and get her to speak with her hands and all that sort of thing. And it was a very dramatic thing, very different from the Western kind of fun thing we'd done the year before. And I started the play as the German professor who taught Annie Sullivan about how to work with deaf people. So I had my German accent, and I had this gray wig on. I wouldn't need a wig now, would I?
No, you look good with that gray hair.
I had a gray wig on and a kind of a mustache and a beard and all that. And then I gave my speech telling Annie how to go off in the world and teach people and all that off stage. And while I was giving that speech, I changed my makeup and my costume to become Helen Keller's father. And then when I came back on stage as her father, I had a southern drawl. and so I was two different accents as two different characters. And I had a riotous time because the other senior playing Annie Sullivan, the teacher of Helen Keller, was a gal who'd been kind of my girlfriend in ninth grade, and we didn't talk to each other too much, but we did the lines we had to do. But there was one scene in which she gets locked into a second floor bedroom, and I have to put a ladder up against the window of this, you know, very poor looking house, because it was a high school set,
yeah,
right, and climb up the ladder and carry her down, which wasn't easy because she was almost as tall as I was. And I carried her down, and I got three, and it was a ladder built by our shop, you know, and it wasn't that solid, apparently. I got three rungs from the bottom, and the rung with two of us weight on it gave out. So then my feet hit the next rung, and it gave out. Then my feet hit the bottom rung, and it gave out, and I landed up on the bottom. It was not supposed to be a funny scene. But the audience went crazy because the ladder broke the last three rungs. I didn't drop her. I did not drop Sandy. I put her down gently, and we went on with the play. But it was very hard not to laugh.
Oh, my gosh, yeah. Nobody got hurt.
Nobody got hurt. Everything was fine.
Well, we're going to go off to college after the news break, all
right?
Sounds
good.
You're listening to The One, 95.1 FM and KYMN 1080 AM on your dial from Northfield, Minnesota, 10 o'clock.
Man,
Manafort trial, Pope speaks out. I'm John Trout. Jury deliberations are getting underway in the bank and fraud case against President Trump's former campaign manager, Paul Manafort. Correspondent Jessica Schneider reports the defense enters court today on an upbeat note.
Paul Manafort's lawyer just walked into court. As he did, he put it this way. He said, "I feel pretty good. My client feels pretty good as well. So we'll see what this day brings."
1 week after a grand jury issues allegations of sexual abuse against priests in Pennsylvania, the Pope has reacted. Correspondent Steve Kastenbaum with wording from the Vatican.
The Pope wrote that no effort must be spared to create a culture able to prevent things like this from happening. Pope Francis forcefully condemned these atrocities, as he wrote, and said they must join forces in uprooting this culture of death. He said the victim's pain and suffering never disappears.
President Trump says a New York Times story that claims White House counsel Don McGahn has been cooperating with the special counsel in the Russia probe is a fake piece. Comments made on Twitter. Afghanistan's president is offering a months-long ceasefire with the Taliban if the militant group agrees to honor it. Officials with interests in the region are heralding the news. Correspondent Ivan Watson.
The NATO Secretary General has welcomed this proposal. The Pakistani Foreign Ministry has welcomed this, as has the U.S. Secretary of State, who, in a written statement, went on to write, quote, "We remain ready to support, facilitate, and participate in direct negotiations between the Afghan government and the Taliban."
Missouri City, Texas police say a female employee opened fire at a food distribution center overnight, killing one person and wounding another. The suspect was shot and later died. Early trading on Wall Street finds electric car maker Tesla down 5.3% after J.P. Morgan cut its price target. I'm John Trout.
When I get older, losing my head, many years from now, will you still be sending me a Valentine? Birthday greetings, bottle of wine. If I've been out till 2:45, you lock the door. Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64?
Hello, everybody. Welcome back. Paul McCartney getting a little bit of exposure here on the Wayne Eddy Affair for the last 13 years.
Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64?
Bump, bump. We are going to continue our conversation with what I think is a very interesting man, Jerry Lance. He is the CEO, the president, and artistic director for the Rochester Symphony Orchestra, but he also does a lot of other things outside of that particular job, musically, in Minneapolis and maybe St. Paul.
Yeah, I lived for a long time in the cities. Before I took the administrative side, became president and CEO, I was just doing the conducting of the Rochester Symphony, so I had a number of things I did up in the cities, and I've kept a couple of them. One I mentioned earlier, the Minneapolis Pops Orchestra. We did 13 concerts in July. Had a great time. And every Sunday before the Sunday concert, my wife and I would stop here in Northfield, have a little snack on the way up to do the Sunday concert.
At the Hideaway,
that's true.
Point number 75, are the members of the band paid for these pop concerts?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes.
Okay.
We have people who are from the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra who don't have a summer season. They're off in the summer. People from the Minnesota Opera Orchestra. A couple from the Rochester Symphony as well. And various freelance musicians, as we call them up there.
Okay.
They're paid. And the Rochester Symphony people are paid as well.
Is it union?
In the Twin Cities, yes. Absolutely.
So the people from Rochester get the Twin City Union fee?
Yeah, I am in the Twin Cities Union. I've been in the Twin Cities Union for almost 40 years.
What's it called?
It's Local 30-73 of the American Federation of Musicians.
Oh, okay.
Yep, AFM.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I was asked to be a member of AFTRA.
Actors.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And to do commercials on television.
Yep.
You can do one without being in the union.
I did one,
but
I was asked. I auditioned for they wanted to do a conductor. I'll tell you the story because it's fun.
Okay,
it probably happened in I'd say the late 70s. They put out the advertisement that they needed someone to be a conductor in a commercial, and then you had to stop conducting. And it was a commercial for a bank in Kentucky being filmed by a production company from Virginia, but they were filming in Minneapolis. Go figure. Actually, no, they filmed in St. Paul is where we filmed, okay? And I auditioned for it, and they said, well, don't call us, we'll call you,
yeah.
as they always did. And then about 3 days before they were going to do it, I figured I didn't get it, they called me and said, the guy who was an actor who was hired to do it has an eye infection, and we can't phone him. I mean, his eye looks terrible. We can't use him. Can you come and do it? And they said, we'll have a set of tails for you. I have my own tails, thank you. And so I went, and I had to do a concert that evening. It was a Friday evening in Rochester. So it was actually into the 80s because of early 1980s. But during the day, I was free. I said, I got to be done by 4 because my concert starts at 7 in Rochester. And so I went to this auditorium, O'Shaughnessy Auditorium on St. Catherine's.
St. Thomas.
St. Thomas.
It's on St. Catherine's. Well, there's
campus.
Two of them. But.
Yeah. They had set up this track on which they had a car, and there was a camera on the car and a guy sitting behind it, and it would peel across while I conducted. And they said, do you know the first movement of the Mendelssohn Italian Symphony? I said, sure. I said, well, we're going to do the end of that, and then it's going to stop all of a sudden. And they're going to be filming you, and then the camera's going to pan back, and they're going to see that what you have been conducting is a tape recorder, and the tape will be spinning there because it broke, and there's going to be just empty chairs and a couple of stands on the stage. And they said, this is what would happen if the so-and-so bank did not support the arts, okay? And that was the commercial, 30 seconds.
Great idea.
Yeah, and so I filmed that during the day, and I came down to Rochester, and I got a note from AFTRA saying, you can do one.
Yep.
Don't ever try to do this again without joining.
Okay.
And I never did one again.
And
so
did
I never
you
did
save the check or did you cash it?
Oh, I cashed it in those days. They actually sent me a couple other checks later because they were showing it a number of times, and therefore I got residuals. Yeah.
Do you have it on VC?
No.
No,
it's gone. It's gone forever, and thank goodness for that.
I was just looking for a tape that I had in 1964, 8mm, of a horrible crash at the Indy 500.
Wow.
And I was so close to it, I could feel the heat.
Wow.
And I misplaced the reel-to-reel, and I want to get it. I guess they said they can't do 8mm. But anyhow, the Pavic Museum of Broadcasting in St. Louis Park.
Sure. It's a great place.
They will switch anything from anything. If you've got cassette, they'll put it on CD. If you want it on your iPad, whatever.
One of the most fun 5 or 10 minutes of my life was I was guest conducting the Indianapolis Symphony. A member of the board of the symphony was a head judge for the Indy 500. He was the guy who made the decisions as to what was going to happen.
Wow.
And he said, hey, would you like to go around the Indianapolis 500 track in a pace car? I said, are you kidding? He said, I can crank it up pretty fast, too. I'll take it over 100. I said, let's go. So I couldn't drive. I was not allowed to drive because I was not official, but he was. And he drove me. I went around the Indy 500 a couple of times at over 100 miles an hour with my friend, who, and it was a thrill.
Oh, I guess so.
Yeah.
The Brickyard, yeah.
Yep, in the Brickyard.
I used to sell newspapers there. I lived in Indianapolis in the 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th grade. And I would go out there, when I was in the seventh grade, I went out and sold newspapers, and they had a press right there.
Mm-hmm.
And if when the finish of the race, the checkered flag comes out, they start printing, and you go out and you hold up a newspaper.
Oh, sure.
A.J. Foyt wins Indy 500.
Absolutely, and you sold a million of them. Yeah. You couldn't keep up with the sales on that. That's the
souvenirs.
Yeah. Are you kidding?
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Well, that's another deal we got going.
Hey, we were both in Indianapolis at one time.
How long were you in Indianapolis?
Well, I would go down there and guest conduct.
Okay.
One year I guest conducted for them their education concerts. I did 38 performances of the same program. Was I tired of that music?
Yeah.
all for kids. Yeah.
Did you ever hear Broad Ripple? When you were there?
No.
Okay. Broad Ripple was just outside the city.
Huh.
And that's where David Letterman went to high school.
Wow.
How about that?
There you go.
We are talking to Jerry Lance. And Jerry, we kind of got you out of high school, I think.
Yeah, I got to tell you one cute story, though, from my end of high school, graduation day.
Okay.
Graduation day, I had never been on an airplane in my life. I got what I thought at the time was the neatest summer job. I was appointed the assistant piano accompanist for the Fred Waring Music Workshops.
Oh, I remember Fred Waring.
Yeah, well, it's Fred Waring lived near where I lived, Shawnee on the Delaware, his golf course and all that, and the whole operation was right there. So I knew people who were involved in that, and I was hired to be the assistant accompanist. The older guy, the major accompanist, was a professional, many years older than I, and you know, many years of experience and all that. But I was an 18-year-old kid, and I was hired to be the assistant. So I had to fly on the day of my graduation, Sunday. We had graduation on Sunday. I had to fly that day to Lake Junaluska, North Carolina. I'd never been in North Carolina. I was a Pennsylvania boy. I didn't know anything about that. I'd never been on a plane in my life, and I was flying alone. Nobody was flying with me, and they were going to meet me at the airport and take me to where this music workshop, kind of a camp deal, was taking place. So on the day of I made my speech. I was valedictorian. I made my speech, and then I got my diploma, and I walked right off stage. I shook hand and walked right off stage, and they kept on going because I had to make the flight. And I flew down there, and we had a meeting Sunday evening, and they were trying to decide which sessions Dave would play piano for and which sessions Jerry would play piano for. Well, everybody looked at Dave, and they looked at this 18-year-old kid, and everybody wanted Dave, you know. But one of the conductors of the sessions was willing to take me, Clyde Seckler. Clyde was about my parents' age. He said, "I'll take Jerry. We'll have a good time together." And I was really indebted to him. And later, all the other guys took me eventually, too. When I showed, I knew what I was doing. But Clyde turned out to be not only a choral director, but he wrote jingles for commercials. And he could have retired right then because he had written things like, "Wouldn't You Really Rather Have a Buick?" and "Winston Tastes Good Like a Cigarette Should." Remember that one?
Yes, I do.
Clyde wrote that music. He didn't have to work a day after that.
Yep.
But he still did, and he still wrote choral arrangements. And I was in a church in the Twin Cities not long ago. I pulled out an arrangement of, I think it was Bridge Over Troubled Water, Simon Garfunkel's song, choral arrangement, arranged by Clyde Seckler. My old friend from way back then.
Wow.
Yeah.
Winston's taste good. Click, click, like a cigarette should.
That's the one. And that's the one Clyde wrote that made him a pile of money.
LMFT.
LSMFT.
Yeah, Lucky Strikes.
That's Lucky Strikes means fine tobacco.
Yeah, well, thank you. Thank you very much. How about I used to put together, I worked with people that were in the jingle business.
Sure.
And then they come to a market and they work with the local people to get, you know, jingles for little small town businesses, comparatively speaking.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd go out and sell these jingles. And I remember the salesman, who ended up being my best man in my wife Julie and I's wedding.
Mm-hmm.
And he would look people in the eye and he says, "Do you remember," and he'd do a nursery rhyme, "Do you remember," and he'd do a little song from when you were a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, that's what it's all about, rhythm and rhyme.
Yep.
Rhythm and rhyme.
Yep.
And so we'll put this jingle together, and we'll have rhythm and rhyme, and people will remember it.
Absolutely.
And what's funny about it, I can tell the story now. We worked with the bank, and the bank bought the commercial, and we played it back for them, and I start giggling. And I couldn't keep a straight face, but I couldn't tell why. And the president of the bank said, well, what's so funny? I said, oh, I just think that this is a fun rhythmic. Well, here's what happened. A national commercial music jingle was made for a huge corporation. And the small market people were sold something almost identical in regards to the music. But it was different enough that it wasn't exactly the same.
Sure.
Now, I'm going to give you the jingle. Hold the pickle, hold the lettuce, special orders don't upset us. All we want to do is let us have it your way.
Yes.
And that was, you're the musician guy, and they just kind of tweaked it differently.
Oh, boy. You can get sued for that.
Not for, I don't know, but if it's different.
If it's different, but it sounds like it was derived from it.
Well,
you can get sued for that. There have been many lawsuits, mostly about popular songs that are very successful.
Right.
They stole my melody.
I understand that. Yeah. And Paul McCartney got in that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But the deal was is that if you didn't know where it came from, you would just say, well, that sounds good.
Yeah, sure.
You know, and, and it did, and they bought it, and it worked. But
all right.
While they were singing about the phrases of the bank, I'm doing hold the pickles, hold the lettuce in my mind, and so I couldn't stop giggling.
Oh, boy.
17 minutes after 10 o'clock with our guest Jerry Lance here on KYMN Radio, we got him a valedictorian.
Yeah,
in high school.
Yeah.
Man, you must have been popular.
Well, I really was. I was too smart, you know.
Okay.
I was one of those guys that if anybody ever beat me on a test, you know, then there was like they had a party.
Okay.
Somebody got beat Jerry on a test.
When did you realize that you were blessed with a brain that functions higher than most people?
Well, in fifth grade, I mentioned earlier that I was at this elementary school that was involved with a college where they taught teachers how to teach. So in fifth grade, some of these young college students would take me out of class and try to teach me extra stuff because I was sitting there basically bored in class. And so they were fussing over me and that. And then in sixth grade, when we were finishing up sixth grade, the four or five smartest kids in the class were brought in by the principal and said, now, you've been the smartest kids in the class here. When you get to junior high, where we bring in, you know, eight other elementary schools, they have smart kids, too, and you won't be the smartest kids in class anymore. And then I got into seventh grade, and I was still the smartest kid in the class. So I realized I've got something special. I've got to work hard and do the best I can with it. So I always worked hard as a student.
Was your brother, your older brother, good in school?
He was valedictorian also.
How about your sister?
She was, I think, third in her class.
Okay.
So.
Did you tease her about that?
Definitely not.
Yeah. How much younger?
Three.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Did you go to the prom?
Yeah.
How many times?
Only the senior year.
Okay.
Junior year, I didn't go. Senior year, my date was, I mentioned Fred Waring Music Workshops before, Fred Waring's granddaughter.
Okay. And was it a convenient thing, or was it your girlfriend?
She was my girlfriend in
okay.
high school, yeah. Yeah, we kept it going a little bit into college, and then, you know, it just...
Life hits you.
Yeah, yeah.
So, did you have any area in your community where you can go swimming?
Sure, Broadheads Creek. Broadheads Creek was a creek that went between Stroudsburg and East Stroudsburg, out from East Stroudsburg. And, of course, we were high rivals, you know, Stroudsburg versus East Stroudsburg football game on Thanksgiving morning every year. Oh, boy.
Really?
Oh, yeah, Thanksgiving morning. Yeah.
Wow.
And my mother taught chemistry and physics at Bangor High School, and Bangor versus Panarjo, which was there, was on Thanksgiving afternoon. So every Thanksgiving, I went to two football games before dinner.
Wow.
Before turkey dinner. Yeah.
That takes discipline, I would imagine.
Well,
you want to get home and eat.
Yeah, right. Yeah. But that was our Thanksgiving.
What did your father do?
He sold life insurance.
Okay. So, was he successful?
Yep.
Okay. So, was your family upper class or middle upper class?
Middle. Pretty much.
Middle.
Yeah, pretty middle. Okay. Maybe a little bit above average, but yeah.
Okay.
And when it was time to send me off to college, we had to figure out how to do that. And the nice thing is, both of my parents were single children, which is really odd. I had no cousins.
Oh,
no first
yeah.
cousins.
Yeah.
No aunts or uncles. Great aunts, great uncles, but no, you know, aunts or uncles, no first cousins. And so they inherited money from both sides of the family. And so there was some money there to send us to college. So when it came time for college, I applied to two colleges only. One was Cornell University. I had spent the summer there between junior and senior years in high school. I wanted to get ahead in math, and there was no AP, advanced placement, in my high school. We were kind of behind at times. So I took calculus there, took a full year of calculus. Oh, God, there's so many stories. I had a wonderful professor there from...
where is the Cornell?
Oh, Cornell is in Ithaca, New York.
Okay.
It's one of the Ivy League schools
All right.
up there. And good
I
point.
Went to Brown.
Did Brown, the broadcasting school in the Twin Cities, which is a great place. Yeah, been there.
Well,
yeah.
It's done. The corporate bought it.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
didn't know that.
It just went down the tubes.
So. Oh, yeah. But I went up to Cornell, and Professor Netanyahu from Israel was my professor. Really interesting guy.
What was his name?
Netanyahu, which means gift of God or given by God.
Is that where Yahoo got its internet or whatever?
Don't think so. But I found out years later that Benjamin Netanyahu, who is now prime minister of Israel and has been for some years, was my calculus professor's nephew.
Okay.
Which is really interesting. And he was a guy who came into class without anything. He didn't carry a pencil. He didn't carry a briefcase. He came in, he picked up the chalk and started writing equations and talking about it. And then when he was done, an hour or 2 hours later, 2 hours in the morning, 1 hour in the afternoon of calculus, he would walk out. That would be it. I mean, he had it all in his head. He was unbelievably brilliant.
Well, for the listeners that aren't aware, and the man speaking, I never asked this question before. Calculus.
Yeah.
What is that? I mean, I know about arithmetic, algebra, higher algebra.
Trigonometry.
Yeah. That one I failed, but anyhow. So calculus, you know, you hear calculator.
Right.
So what is calculus?
Calculus is the study of microcosmic changes. When certain things change in equations and in graphs and stuff like that, what is the result of those changes? And they can be infinitesimal. And how? What equations do you get out of that? And it's very real-world based. The opposite of there's differential calculus and integral calculus, and they both have to do with changes, and they have a great deal to do with calculating the forces on airplane wings that are created by moving them through the air, and where you have to reinforce those wings to make sure they don't break and things like that.
Oh.
And there's a lot of stuff that's based on calculus.
But there was calculus before airplanes.
Oh, long before.
Yeah.
Leibniz and Newton, Isaac Newton, created these things, calculus, in the 1600s. And they both came up with it at about the same time because, you know, the ideas were in the air. And one can argue whether Leibniz, the German, or Newton, the Englishman, really created calculus. But they invented it separately at the same time.
So who invented gravity or discovered gravity?
Well, gravity everybody kind of knew about, but... codifying it into equations and how it worked. That was Newton also,
yep.
And law of motions and all that. Same guy.
Okay. Is he the guy that named the trees? Or
No.
No Fig Newton?
No. But a guy named Linnaeus was the guy who figured out in the late 1700s, a Swede figured out all the way we name, you know, genus, what is it, kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus, species, you know, how we name everything. There were guys back there very smart doing all this stuff.
So, did you, what were you thinking?
I went to calculus at Cornell. So I interviewed there at Cornell, and they said, we'll let you in. We'd love to have you at Cornell. So usually you have to apply to a lot of different schools, hoping to get in one. I knew I had Cornell in the bag. So the only other one I applied to was the one my brother was already at, which was Yale. And the reason Yale was so exciting to me is that it had any subject you wanted, but it had a music school also. It's the only Ivy League school that had a music school. And I didn't want to go into music. I'm in music now, but I didn't want to go into music then, because most of the musicians I knew were high school teachers who wanted to be performers. Whatever they played, whether it was clarinet or violin or whether they were a singer or whatever, they wanted to be doing that professionally. But because there are so many people that are so talented who get to do that, they were unable to make the grade, and so they ended up teaching school, and they were unhappy.
Okay.
So I said, I don't want to be an unhappy school music teacher, so I will keep music as an avocation. I'll do it for fun, and I want to go into something else. So I knew that Yale had a wonderful program to do music, but you could participate in it even if you weren't a music major. So I thought, I decided to go there. And it worked out to be a great place for me. And I was going to study math because I love that calculus stuff, you know. It was great. But then as it got higher and higher, it got more and more abstract, and it wasn't me. So I ended up in a math-related field. I majored in economics.
Oh, interesting.
And I continued to do music. I played in the band, marching band and concert band. I played in the symphony orchestra. I had never played in a symphony orchestra before because there wasn't one in my high school. There was none around where I grew up. So I played in my college orchestra, and I got really involved in the organization. Eventually, I became president of the orchestra toward the end of my sophomore year, and my brother at that time was president of the band. It's the only time in history that the Yale Band and Yale Symphony have been presidents by siblings simultaneously, which is kind of fun. And so I went all the way through school. I had wonderful time in college. I mean, I remember end of my freshman year, we had an almost a month. It was 4 weeks trip to Europe with the Yale University Concert Band. And the nice thing was there were enough alumni gifts that things like planes and hotels and all that were taken care of. We had to pay for some meals.
Were you doing bugle?
Trombone.
Were you doing trombone at that? Were you first chair?
I was second chair all the way through college.
How did that affect your ego?
Well, I'll tell you. Let me tell you. I met Rich the beginning of my freshman year.
Rich.
Yeah, Rich DeProspo, wonderful guy, very smart, and a magnificent trombone player. And we were even though we were only freshmen, we were the two best trombones in the Yale undergraduate organization. And all the way through, he was first trombone in the band and the orchestra, and I was second in the band and the orchestra. And I just had to live with it because Rich was better than I was. He just was better at playing trombone than I was, and so it went.
Did he have a love for jazz like you did?
No. That was an interesting thing. There was no jazz band at Yale when I got there, so my brother and I started one. And my brother is more the organizational type.
What instrument was he?
He was piano and tuba. In the band and orchestra, he played tuba, but in the jazz band, he played piano. And so we started a jazz band, and I got to be first trombone there because Rich wasn't interested in playing trombone in the jazz band. So I lucked out in that sense.
Yeah. Well, it's 10:29 on 1080 Radio. We're going to take a brief break, and we'll be right back, and we'll continue our conversation with a gentleman that I find very interesting, and we'll also remind you about what's going on at 11 o'clock on 15 with the author.
When King Cobra strikes, the world trembles. Noah's Ark introduces Raja, the world's largest king cobra, raced through 330 feet of coiled intensity. 6 stories high, over 30 miles an hour. Come face to face with Raja, the most thrilling new ride of the summer, only at America's largest water park, Noah's Ark. Save up to $18 on select days when you buy tickets online at noahsarkwaterpark.com.
Are you tired of that icky old shower, crumbling old tile, or outdated bathtub? Rebath can help in as little as one day. Rebath is locally owned and would be glad to meet with you for a free estimate. Call us today at 1-800-BATH-TUB to turn that old bathroom into new.
We're back on KYMN Radio. Good morning. It's 1029 on 1080 Radio. And by the way, a 2016 report indicated that nearly 34% of students between the ages 12 and 17 have been victims of cyberbullying. Children face real dangers online, but how can parents protect their children without isolating them from the reality of our digitally connected world? On today's 15 with the author, Terry Knight talks with Will Geddes. He is one of the world's leading security specialists, and he's out with a new book, Parent Alert, How to Keep Your Kids Safe Online. The book is set up with real-life scenarios and action plans, how to balance protecting your kids from danger without being critical of them. And, well, you'll learn a lot more at 11 o'clock this morning, 1/2 hour from now, on 15 with the author with KYMN's Terry Knight. But I'm with the president, the CEO, the artistic director of the Rochester Symphony. I'm with a guy by the name of Jerry Lance, and this is part three, I believe, and we're talking about different things. And we kind of got you out of high school. You went to the prom with an old girlfriend, or girlfriend at that time, and you guys went off to college, and that was the end of that.
Yep.
So you had Cornell wrapped up. You knew that in the back, and you wanted to go to a prestigious school, an Ivy League school.
Well, I wanted to get a real good education and be really challenged.
Okay.
I wanted to be really challenged because, frankly, in high school and all that, I hadn't been all that challenged.
Oh.
I wanted to go to a place where I really had to, you know, sharpen up. And, boy, did I ever.
Now, tell me, you graduated from Yale in, let me guess, 71?
Yes, sir.
Okay. In 1968.
Yes.
We had horrible things going on in this country. Martin Luther King was killed. Senator Kennedy was killed.
Yep.
The war in Vietnam was hot.
Yes.
You're in the age bracket now where you could be drafted if you
yep.
didn't have a student deferment.
Absolutely.
But where were you and what were you thinking and what did you do or wish you could do in regards to that horrible 68 year?
It was a frightening and fascinating time. I was my dad always said that the best years of his life were the years that he was in the Army during World War II. He was drafted 9 months before Pearl Harbor. People are not aware they actually had a draft. The first draft, I think, was in October of 1940. Remember, December 41 is when the war began with Pearl Harbor. In October of 40, more than a year before that, there was the first draft. My dad was drafted in March of 41, 9 months before Pearl Harbor. He was already a sergeant by the time Pearl Harbor came along. He became a lieutenant within a couple months after that and participated in the whole anti-Nazi fight. He was unable to be in the front lines in a combat unit because he was deaf in one ear. When he was being born, they used forceps to pull him out.
I've heard of that.
And one forceps went through an ear of his and shattered it. So he was deaf in one ear, which meant you can't tell direction of sound with only one ear. So he was in ordnance and quartermaster. He was supplying the front lines, but he went across Africa. He went up through Italy and the invasion of southern France, which was in August of 44, a couple months after D-Day of northern France, and up into Germany. He was in the army for 5 years. And eventually, when the war was over, he was done and he went into business.
Did he have a college education?
Yes.
And that's why he got his second lieutenant and moved on
up?
Okay. Yes.
Yes. He went to the University of Pennsylvania, Wharton School, which is their business school, in preparation for his career in life insurance and all that. So he had been through college before the war. Graduated from college in 38 and then in 41.
Is that the same one President Trump attended, Wharton?
Wharton's, I don't know.
Okay. I think he did.
He may have. I honestly don't
okay.
know.
Okay. So did he tell you, one of the things I really enjoy is talking to Second World War veterans and their...
I was talking to one yesterday, a Navy veteran. Fascinating.
Yeah. And I've had many stories on them. Did the Did your dad share?
Yes.
His experience.
I'll tell you one story. My dad told me it was when he was in Africa. Shortly after arriving there, he went over in the first wave. But again, he was not in a combat. He was not in artillery.
He was in infantry.
No, he was in supply.
Right.
And as a man in supply, he was a lieutenant. He was in charge of a company, and all the men who worked in his company repaired pistols. That was their job. They repaired pistols. And he was not only in charge of that company that repaired them. He didn't know how to repair them. That wasn't his job. His job was to keep it organized and keep it going. He was also the assistant to a colonel. He was the adjutant, the assistant to the colonel who was in charge of that entire brigade or whatever it was that his unit was part of. And so he would sit in his office, which was in a tent in the desert in North Africa, and that was the way you had to go through his office to get to the colonel's office, which was another tent. And one day he was sitting there working at his desk, and he saw in front of him a pair of ivory-handled revolvers on each side of a person. There's only one person in the Army who wore ivory-handled revolvers.
I shall return.
No, it wasn't MacArthur. It was Patton.
Oh, yeah,
S. Patton was the guy. MacArthur was over in the Pacific. But Patton was there standing in front of me. My dad leaps to attention. General Patton, sir, how can I help you, sir? And he said, may I see the colonel? Now, even though he's the commanding general of the Army, he still has to ask permission to go into the office of the colonel. That's the way it's done. I said, just a minute, sir. I will check. And he goes, the colonel will be happy to see you, sir.
Yeah.
Okay. And on his way out, Patton said, what are you working on there, Lieutenant? He said, well, General, my men know how to repair pistols. And so I'm working on taking apart and putting back together pistols so I can better understand the job they do. He said, how's it going? My dad said, well, taking it apart was real easy. So several months later, they're in a different part of North Africa. My dad is still the adjutant to the colonel. He's still working at his desk in the tent. And again, he sees the ivory-handled pistols right in front of him. He snaps to attention. General Patton, sir. He said, may I see the colonel, please? Yes, sir. I'll ask the colonel. So he came back. Yes, the colonel would be happy to see you. And Patton, before he went in, he said, Lieutenant, did you ever get that pistol together? He remembered my dad after all those months. My dad said, I would have followed that guy anyplace.
Yeah.
He was a real leader.
Yeah. George Scott.
George Scott, 1970 film. Yep. Great film.
10:37 on 1080 radio, somewhat overcast, and this is Monday. It is the 20th day of August, and the year is 2018. Do you have children?
I do.
Okay, well, because, you know, you can download this and your grandkids. You have grandkids?
I do. I have two.
Okay. Well, when they're, how old are they?
3 and about 4 months.
Well, 25, 30 years from now, they'll listen to this and know all about their grandfather.
They'll know way more than I want them to, right?
Oh, no. It is fun. I really enjoy your stories.
I brought up my dad in the Army because he was very much an Army guy. And he insisted that my brother and I both sign up for ROTC, Reserve Officer Training Corps. So my brother was a junior when I went in as a freshman to Yale. He was a junior in the Yale ROTC. I went in as a freshman. I served in ROTC for a year and a half, and I just couldn't stand it anymore. It wasn't the ROTC program. ROTC program was wonderful. And the men we had there, the sergeant major, I remember Major Higginbotham very well, excellent men, excellent examples of what a soldier ought to be, and I learned a great deal. But what I couldn't stand was the Vietnam War. I just was not in support of the war. I could not stay in the Army, which was supporting that war. So I met with Major Higginbotham and said, I'm sorry, sir, I have to resign. And I explained my reasons. He understood. He was a gentleman. He understood. And I said, this has been great working with you, et cetera. So then, a few months later, in the fall, we had the first lottery for the draft. And at the beginning of that evening, I mean, we were all scared to death. Because, as you recall, what happens, they pull these balls out of a hat or a tub or whatever, and they would pull out 366 balls, which is how many different birthdays there are. And if you had a birthday in the first 100 or maybe even 200, you were going to get drafted. And if you were above 200, you had lesser chance. You were above 300, you had no chance of getting drafted. So the first part of that night, I was at a rehearsal playing my trombone. I came back, and they were in the 90s. Okay, so either some of my buddies there who were getting very soused because they had already been pulled, and they were not happy. So it started in the 90s, and I was listening. And nobody had kept track of all the birthdays, so I didn't know whether my birthday had been taken in the first 90 or not. And we get all the way through the 90s, and we get all the way through the 100s, and they haven't had my birthday. And we get all the way through the 200s, and they haven't had my birthday. And there's only, you know, 65, 66 left in the 300s. And we get to 320, 330, and I'm dying because I know my number's in the first 90. Yeah, I'm dead. I'm going to Vietnam.
So, now, could they pull you right out of college?
No, I had student deferment.
Yeah.
But right after college.
Okay.
They could take me.
I get it. Yeah.
And Vietnam War didn't look like it was winding down at all at that point. So finally, 347, February 6th, I got picked. And 347, I was safe. And I felt, you know, the hugest sigh of relief I've ever felt in my life, I think. I wasn't going to get drafted. A number of my friends were, and I enjoyed them in their misery. I commiserated them by drinking some beer, too.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I remember that 1968 very well.
Jerry, KYMN came here in 1968.
Yes, sir.
And one of the things that I'll never forget, it was indelible, was the protest against the Vietnam War that was put on by, I want to say St. Olaf, but perhaps Carleton participated.
Sure.
And I remember them down on Bridge Square by the river, and they had the death guy, you know, with the black robe and the sickle or whatever you call it.
Sure.
Representing death with the mask. And then a guy with a drum. And they were naming names of those killed in Vietnam.
Mm.
Boom, Wayne Eddy. Boom, Jerry Lance. And there were all these students. And at that time, I don't know if they did it at Yale, but they were wearing long hair and, you know, ragstock type clothes. Well, just, you know, goofy clothes.
Yep.
And I just went by, and being a businessman with a short haircut, and I went by and I thought, boy, that's kind of indulging themselves in their protests, taking up the town square.
Mm-hmm.
And I was for the U.S. government, and I changed my mind. It was just you know, ridiculous. And you were right in there. I got drafted in 64. So I would have been in that little mess if I had been physically accepted.
Yep.
So the fear is over with. But how did you respond with your fellow students on a Yale campus in regards to speakers or demonstrations?
Well, there was a lot of that going on. And I have a lot of stories to tell.
Well, tell
about
me
One was when I was a senior, we decided to go to Washington, D.C. to take our protest.
1971.
Yeah, this is in fall of 70.
Okay.
And I had a friend, Joshua Javits. Josh's dad was a senator from New York named Jacob Javits.
Yeah.
And so, and he was against the war. He's a Republican who was against the war. And in those days, Republicans spread across a wider spectrum of politics than they do today. And they weren't as right-wing as they are today. There were liberal Republicans as well, and Senator Jacob Javits was one of those. And Josh said, let's go down to Washington. I had a car, and we'll take several guys down, and we'll use my dad's office as our center of operation, and we'll get appointments and talk to everyone. Will try to talk to his own congressman and his own two senators. And so that's what we did. And I went down and I talked to Senator Hugh Scott, who was Senate I think it was minority leader then, because I think Republicans were in the minority. And he was one of the two guys who went along with Goldwater to talk to Nixon some years later, saying, "We can't stop this impeachment. You should resign." And Nixon then resigned. This is some years later. But I talked to Senator Scott. I talked to Senator Lowell Schweiker, who was my senator, as well. And I talked to my congressman, too. And I'm sorry, I can't remember his name. And we... you know, we put on our suits. We got our haircut a little shorter. We put on our three-piece suits and our white shirts and ties and went to see the senators. And they and the interesting thing about that, Wayne, was that they were very happy to talk to us, but it was very clear we weren't changing anybody's mind. Whoever was against the war was against the war. Whoever was in favor of the war was in favor of the war. And our whole attempt to do it, we were wasting our time. You know, it's not that they weren't listening to people, but they had made their minds up, and that was
Did
done.
You know that at that time?
Nope. Not until I went to the offices and talked to them.
Yeah, so you were naive in regards to thinking
yes,
that you could...
Yes, totally naive is exactly the word. Yes, sir.
And you must have friends that were in the Army.
I had friends who were in the Army. I'm blessed to say I didn't know anybody close to me that was killed. But I had friends who were definitely in the Army, and I heard stories later. It turned out I went last summer to my 50th high school reunion, and I found out that one of the guys I knew, I'd totally lost touch, one of the guys I knew had been to Vietnam and a couple of tours of duty, and several years later, this guy I knew in high school, not well, but I'd known him, committed suicide because he couldn't get over the PTSD
yeah.
from having been two tours in Vietnam.
Yeah, and I have a similar situation. I went to my 50th, and there were some guys that had to go to Nam, and you know, you know, what do they say? The past is 2020 vision.
Oh yeah,
and you think, what a waste of money, what a waste of lives, what a waste. Now you think, and this is a Wayne editorial.
Mm-hmm.
What about Afghanistan now? You know,
Iraq, Afghanistan, that whole thing.
18,
yeah.
17 years they've been fighting. Russians couldn't do it.
It's
and,
tough.
You know,
it's a tough call. We've had very fine people over there doing their duty. Yes.
What? I think to myself, well, if you pull on out, well, then what happens? And then I think, well, how do you take over and win? How do you ever win against guerrillas? And if you can't win, why be in the fight? And, of course, that was Vietnam. And
yep.
Can you imagine how those Vietnam veterans that are still living...
Mm-hmm. And there are many.
That went through hell in those
mm-hmm.
jungles.
No question.
Thinking, now, what? I was used. I was just used by politicians.
Friend of
business.
A friend of mine who ended up being a singer, a bass baritone singer in his life, told me the story about he was heading up a patrol. He was going down a trail, went around the corner, and there was a Viet Cong a few feet from him. And it was a question of whether he was going to get his rifle up first or the Viet Cong. Well, Jimmy's still here. Viet Cong.
Yeah, and then there's,
got blown away.
There's many stories that people can tell. It's anyhow, we went off on a tangent there.
A little bit.
Now,
let me tell you another story of 1968. This one is both poignant and sad and also funny. It was a weird thing. Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, great leader for civil rights, was killed April 4th or 6th, I can't remember, of 68. It was a Thursday night. We knew that our chaplain at Yale, the Reverend William Sloan Coffin, had marched with King on a number of occasions and knew him. We had also heard that on Thursday night, as soon as we learned that King had been shot, he made arrangements to fly to Memphis to be with Coretta, Mrs. King, and the family and the other leaders there. So he flew down. And we knew he had flown back Saturday night. Sunday morning, I'm going to chapel to hear the Reverend Coffin, the best preacher I've ever heard, and I'd been to chapel many times before, to hear Bill Coffin speak. And I'm walking down the street, down Elm Street in Yale toward Battelle Chapel. And in front of me, there pulls up into the one parking spot left on Elm Street, a Mustang, a red Mustang. And out of it jumps a person who, from the back, looked very attractive as I was following her down the street. So I got into the chapel, and as usual, I was running late. I'm never late when I'm on the air with you, Wayne. But
I appreciate that.
Very often in life, I'm late. I was a little late to chapel, and everybody knew that the Reverend Coffin had been down to Memphis, and the place was packed. Couldn't find a seat, and she was looking for a seat, and I introduced myself. Hey, were you looking for a seat? I said, come with me. Let's go upstairs. So I went upstairs, and we found seats, not in any of the pews, but in the steps between sections of pews. That was okay. The only thing that was left. Yep. And we heard Bill Coffin preach for an hour about his friend Martin and how much it meant to him to be down in Memphis with Coretta Scott King and about the times they were together and what they had fought for and what Dr. King had died for. And he was a brilliant speaker. He didn't have notes. He just told us about the stories and what it meant. And we were all just electrified. And there wasn't a sound. Everybody was just stunned, and there were tears. And we all went out of there very moved and very, very much in awe of the fact that we were present at a moment in history. And that was really spectacular. So I met this young lady, and I invited her to join me for lunch. You could take guests to the... I said, why are you here? Who are you? What are you here? Turned out she was a student at Mount Holyoke College. Now, at this point, Yale was entirely male. My junior year, we co-edited. But my first 2 years, it was just guys who were undergraduates at Yale. They're female graduate students, but undergrads were all... college students were all male. And so she was there because the Mount Holyoke College Glee Club, all-girls group, was singing Israel and Egypt, a Handel oratorio, not Messiah, one of the other oratorios of Handel, that afternoon in a concert. And so the all-male Yale Glee Club would sing with the all-female Mount Holyoke Glee Club, and they would sing the piece together. I said, I'd heard that was happening. I'll have to come to the concert. So I took her to lunch, and then I saw her at the concert. And I invited her to dinner as well, and then she took off in her Mustang back to Mount Holyoke. And her name, believe it or not, was Sally. She was Mustang Sally.
Absolutely.
It's true. I crossed my heart. I'm not making it up, Wayne. I couldn't make this up. So now here comes the funny part of the thing. I thought this Miss Mustang Sally was a pretty interesting young lady. So I called her up like several days later. I had gotten her phone number. And I said, hello, this is Jim Robertson. I changed my voice a little. I'm a graduate student in psychology at Yale University, and I was talking to a young man the other day named Jerry Lance, and he told me he had met you on Sunday. And I am doing research, my master's thesis, on comparing objective analysis through testing of a personality versus another person's judgment on meeting that person one time. So I am giving Mr. Lance a Fisk-Cotell trait rating scale and other tests, and I'd like you to answer questions based on these tests about what your impressions of his are, and I want to see how closely those answers correspond with what the tests find when he takes the test. And so I went through this whole thing interviewing her, and I said, well, is he shy or is he, you know, friendly? Is he stingy or is he generous? You know, is he difficult or is it easy to get along? There are 20 different things, and she rated me on all these things to the guy, Jim Robertson. Well, Jim Robertson was a buddy of mine. I just used his name. So I said, thank you very much. I, of course, will not disclose to Mr. Lance what you have said about him, but I appreciate your help. It will help me in my master's thesis. And I hung up. A couple of days later, I called Sally up as me. And after we chatted for a while, I said, did you get a call from a Jim Robertson graduate student in psychology? He said, yes, I did. And I didn't say anything. And Sally said, that wasn't you, was it? I said, yes, Sally, it was. She said, you devil. You devil. We never ended up really dating. We never got involved in a romantic relationship, but we ended up good friends.
What color was that dress as you watched her walk away out of her Mustang going to the chapel?
It was a black skirt.
A black skirt, okay. We're going to take a final break,
okay.
And then we'll be back. And here's what I'm going to ask you when we come back. Jerry Lance, I want to know if, and I'm sure you got a story, I just have a feeling about the pudding club or whatever that's called.
A hasty pudding club?
Yeah, don't say anything now.
I have to, say one thing. That's at Harvard. It's not at Yale.
Well, what's the difference? $20,000 a semester, yeah. We'll be right back on KYMN, a friend you can count on.
Hay season is save season at John Deere. For a limited time, enjoy extra savings on select John Deere mower conditioners and round balers. Pay a visit to your local John Deere dealer to learn just how much you can save on these hard-working hay tools and get high performance at a low cost season after season. Offer ends October 26, 2018. Terms and conditions apply. See your John Deere dealer for qualifying products and complete details.
Do you have an old junker car in the garage or on the farm? Call Huber's Auto Parts in Faribault, 507-332-2300. Get the most cash for your old junker vehicle and have it taken away for free. Huber's Auto Parts in Faribault, 507-332-2300.
Residential or commercial, Cannon Valley Water in Dundas is the place to call for water. Whether it's a complete water conditioning system or just salt delivery and filters, Cannon Valley Water can take care of it. And Cannon Valley Water can also deliver Candy Yohai premium water right to your house or business at great rates, too. Chippewa Springs is as pure today as it was when we first tested it over a century ago, and is proudly distributed by Cannon Valley Water. Pickups are now located at 609 Stafford Lane in Dundas, just behind Aldi.
Oh.
Call Cannon Valley for your water today.
I have the Candy Ojai water in my home. We have it here in the KYMN studios. And if you got a problem with water softeners, just give Kenny Johnson a call. Don't forget, coming up in just 5 minutes, it's going to be Terry Knight and her 15 with the author. It'll be pretty interesting. Okay, let's get back to my guests here this morning, the president, the CEO, the artistic director of the Rochester Symphony, and he is from Pennsylvania originally. You're going to have to come back.
I guess so.
Because we still have you in
college.
Yale.
Yeah. And I did graduate, by the way.
I have a feeling that you did, with a major in calculus? Or
Major in economics.
Okay. Boy, that'd be interesting. I have a friend that's 90 now, that was economics professor at Carleton.
Sure.
And so he would have been in the 50s, I think.
Sure.
Or 40s or 50s. Well, you went there in the 40s. But anyhow, to have you both here and talk economics, your era, his era, and this era.
Yeah.
That'd be kind of a cool conversation.
I'm still up on economics to a degree. Only to
okay.
a degree.
Well, and so would he be.
Yeah.
But you remember.
I do.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mentioned at the break the Hasty.
Hasty Pudding Club, that's at Harvard.
And I got the wrong school.
Yeah, that's all right.
And everybody knows about Harvard and Yale. What's the difference between the two, do you think?
I think the fundamental difference, they're both wonderful schools of education. I'm not going to try to tell you that you get a better education at Yale than at Harvard or at Harvard than at Yale. Okay? Harvard has a higher reputation. Harvard is probably the best overall graduate school on the planet. I think Yale may be the best undergraduate school, and this is one reason why. There's a requirement, usually very sophisticated advanced professors love to teach graduate students who are their most advanced students. They know more about their subject. And they don't want to teach more basic courses to undergraduates. Yale requires, I'm basing this on my experience of some years ago, but Yale requires all professors to teach undergraduates as well as graduates. You can't just teach graduate students. And Yale is unusual in that regard. No professor at Yale can only teach graduate students. And so you get contact with the top people in your field as a beginner, and that's a good thing. Another difference between Harvard and Yale, Harvard is highly competitive. If you thrive on competition and you love to be, you know, pumping it out against the person who's in, you know, across the aisle in your calculus class, your economics class, your history class, or whatever, Harvard is very competitive. Yale is known as the friendly Ivy, and that's even more true today. My daughter graduated from Yale in 7 years ago. She was a major in English.
Okay.
And she makes radio now, believe it or not. It's another story, but she makes mostly for public radio. She makes documentaries and things. It's now very true. The story is that if you're at Harvard and you're in a class, you want to you're competing against the next person because the guy across the aisle may be applying to the same graduate.